This call is being recorded.
All right. Well, thank you very much for the introduction, Monique, and for the opportunity to speak to this group. I'm sure that we're all stunned and saddened by the violence, the attacks, the loss of life that's happened in Paris on Friday. The French government and the UN have decided that they're going to go on with COP21 in Paris, that meeting will go on as planned, and that's despite, this is a nation and a city that is grieving, that's in pain. So for those of us who are going to Paris, just suggest that we all walk a little tenderly and respectfully around the city as we move about, and do take some time to talk to Parisians, get a sense of, how they're feeling, what's going on, offer support if you can in solidarity. So while this is a global international meeting that we're going to, I think it's important to pay some respect to our hosts for this meeting. So to give you a little bit of an overview of what I'm going to talk about is, pretty much following what Monique said. I'll talk a bit about who goes to the COPs, why do they go, what do they do there. I'll give you a little bit of background about the UNFCCC, some of the milestones in the negotiations coming up to Paris, what are some of the key issues in Paris, and some expected outcomes, and then a bit about what might come after Paris. If there are questions about security issues, about traveling to Paris and attending the COP, we can take that up in the Q&A period. Okay, so who goes to the COP? Let's see, for last year at COP20 in Lima, Peru, about 15,000 people attended that event. This year in Paris, the reports are that somewhere between 40 and 50,000 people are expected to come. About half of that number will be official delegates with credentials to go into the venue of the UN meeting, what's called the Blue Zone, and participate in what happens there. And about half of that estimated attendance are people who don't have credentials to go into the conference, but will be participating in a variety of public events that are outside the official venue. So amongst those folks who are delegates, who have badges to get into the Blue Zone, somewhere upwards to, maybe as many as 10,000 party delegates will attend. The party delegates, those are individuals who they represent their sovereign nations. Those are the people who are tasked with representing their governments, their people in these negotiations. About 10 to 15,000 observers are expected, and about 3,000 media for it. So quite a large number of people going to this conference. The party delegates, as I said, those are the folks who represent national sovereign governments. They're the ones who actually engage in the negotiations, in developing the content and the text of any agreements, any decisions that are reached at the conference. What goes on at these meetings, you'll have numerous concurrent meetings that are going on. There'll be major plenaries where all of the nations are represented in the plenaries, but there are also contact groups, small working groups, informal discussions that are going on all the time. So there's one of the main ones is what's called the Ad Hoc Working Group on the Durban Platform, the ADP. That's where a lot of the main negotiations will occur in that group. There's also a group meeting to talk about the Kyoto Protocol and the second commitment period, and there'll be side meetings going on mitigation and adaptation, loss and damage, finance, a variety of other issues. So what this means is, since there's so many meetings that go on at the same time, if you can think about, what's the challenge for a national delegation that's relatively small, that's, say, from a developing country that may have a handful of people attending, some might even just have one delegate, and they're challenged with the problem of where should they be at any given moment? What's the most effective use of their time in these negotiations? The U.S. is going to have an army of experts and diplomats in their delegation, and will have, you know, be able to have eyes and ears in every room that they think they need to be in. So those who are not so well resourced tend to work in blocks, in constituency groups, and sharing information to know what's going on in other meetings that they can't attend, and try to work together collaboratively. So those are the official delegates. Now, who goes as observers to these conferences? If you think about the complexity of global climate change and all the different implications it has, all the different ways it affects the planet and society, any issue you can think of, there is an organization, there are groups connected to that issue, and you will find somebody at this conference with those, you know, who have those different interests. To attend as an observer, it's not open to the public. You have to register some months in advance for an organization to get credentials as an observer organization. And then once you're admitted as an organization, you can then nominate delegates to go to the conference. And there's a, you know, it used to be that almost any organization can send, you know, as many folks as they wanted, but now it's become, there's been so much interest that they're having to sort of ration spaces. So it's more difficult to get credentials to go to the COPs now. But you'll see groups that are environmental groups, business groups, city and local government officials, human rights groups, indigenous rights groups, faith groups, economic development groups, civil society groups, scientists, and then folks from colleges and universities will also be in attendance. So you might ask, why are they going? What are they doing there? Since they don't have an official role in the negotiations, what are they going to these conferences for? I've been to 10 of them so far. They are sort of like a medieval fair, just an amazing amount of activity, such a wide range of people and ideas and things going on. There's an exhibit hall where many organizations will have booths where they're sharing information about work that they're doing, doing a variety of things at those booths. They set up side events for discussions, conversations about different topics. The observers can attend some of the official sessions of the COP, primarily the plenaries, and then there's some other contact groups where the observers are allowed in. But some things are closed, and at any point, the officials running the secretariat can decide to exclude observers if any of the national delegates you know, want to have a more private conversation. But there's an awful lot that you can participate in as an observer. Some of the things that observers are doing there, primarily it's about learning and sharing information, going and trying to either learn or share information about how is my community or my place or my business affected by climate change or climate change action. What is being done? Who's doing what? What are the best practices out there? What works? So a lot of the emphasis of the observers is on that kind of sharing of information. They're also trying to build networks, build coalitions to try and advance the work that they do. They're there to advocate, agitate, demonstrate, prod, provoke, trying to get their ideas represented in some way in what's going on in the official process. They're promoting their work, promoting their ideas. Businesses are promoting technologies and products that they have that they think are part of a solution to climate change. So the question might be asked as to, you know, are these observers, are they playing an important role? Are they useful to the process? Or are they just creating a lot of sound and fury and getting in the way? Well, one perspective on that is they really function as the eyes and ears of many different constituencies around the world, that they're watching, they're paying attention and making sure that the national delegates are aware that what they do is not going unnoticed. And I think that is very helpful to the process. Many of the observers bring very important information and perspectives to the COP. So some of them may be authors, scientists with the IPCC or with other scientific organizations, and they bring important information to the process. Others may come from economic development organizations or groups that are doing aid work in the developing world, and they bring important perspectives. Some are coming where they do work in a local community on building resilience and adaptation, and have a really good working knowledge on the ground of the kinds of challenges that are being faced and the objectives and goals that people in their community have. And that's an important perspective to bring to these high-level international discussions. A big part of what they do is help to create the political will for action. So that's an important process of what goes on. I think it's, one of the things that has become evident over the last, say, 10 years is that international agreements really are not, they don't reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Okay, they set maybe the broad parameters in which that can happen, but actually doing something about climate change, that takes action by cities, by businesses, by organizations and individuals. And so these observers are kind of on the forefront of that civil society and private sector aspect of taking action on climate change. I've gone to the COP three times with students from my college, from Dickinson College, took students to Copenhagen, Durban, and Lima. And these have been part of a immersive semester-long programs where it's a group of students who are taking three or sometimes four courses that are all about climate change, on the science of it, policy, international negotiations. And as part of that program, they have a major research project they do on some issue in the negotiations. And part of that research includes going to the COP and doing field work. They interview delegates. They record those interviews. They attend side events. They observe what's going on. And they use that information along with library and online research that they do to write papers. The big part of this is actually being there in person, talking with people who are really fundamentally engaged with this problem, learning from them, finding out what climate change means to them, what are their fears, what are their hopes, what do they want to do on this issue. And it's been a hugely impactful learning experience. So we're still planning to go to COP21 in Paris. We'll see how events play out there. This year I've got two current students and four recent graduates who are going. It's not part of the same kind of program I've done before. We're attending as observers, and each one kind of has their own tasks that they've set out for themselves. So it's a bit different than what we've done before. I'm taking longer to talk through my notes here than I expected. So I think what I'll do is, if you've got questions about the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change and some of the milestones on getting to where we are now in the negotiations, I'd be happy to talk about the Kyoto Protocol, the Bali Action Plan, Copenhagen, the Durban Platform, and those things. But maybe I'll just move on to talking about Paris and what are the key issues there. So in Paris, leading up to it, one of the key things that's happening is each of the parties has been asked to submit what's called an intended national contribution. I can't remember what the D stands for. So these are individual statements by each nation about what is it they're prepared to do. What are they going to contribute to this international agreement? This is different from what's come before, where it's been a more top-down approach of trying to say, here's the overall goal and target of where we're trying to get to in terms of mitigating climate, reducing emissions. And now let's look at how we allocate responsibility for that amongst the different nations. So now it's a more bottom-up approach where each country just says, here's what we're prepared to do, here's what we're willing to do, and in Paris they're going to try and stitch this together into an international agreement. There's been some promising signs in terms of what these contributions state. The United States has said their contribution will be to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions 26 to 28% below the 2005 level by 2025. The EU has a more aggressive target of a 40% reduction below 1990 emissions by the year 2030. China's made a commitment, India's made a commitment, Brazil's made a commitment, other developing countries, and that's a major change from what's come before, is to have these developing countries making some statements about what they're going to do. So that all looks very promising, but one thing to note is, you know, the question is this enough? If all these countries that have put forward these 156 of them have put forward their contributions, and if you add it all up, but different groups have analyzed it and said that where this would get us by the year 2030 is about a 5% reduction in global greenhouse gas emissions, and that reduction in emissions from where we would be without those contributions, instead of the planet warming by, say, 3.5 or so degrees by the end of the century, we might limit it to, say, 2.7 degrees. The goal that's been stated since Copenhagen is to limit warming to less than 2 degrees, and some have advocated to limiting it to less than 1.5 degree. So we're nowhere near that goal, that we'd have to have much more aggressive action than that to get there. So one of the key issues in Paris is, what do we do about that gap? What do we do about this gap between where we appear to be headed with what nations have said they're willing to do and that 2 degrees centigrade or lower target of what we're trying to avoid? There's some who are pushing for sort of a top-down budget approach, as has been done in the past, but more likely is they're just going to Paris accept that there is a gap. But try and really work on a process whereby they will increase what they describe as ambition, to have a periodic review process in which, say, every 5 years, each country reviews, revisits their national contribution, update it, and the idea is agree to take more aggressive action. So getting that piece right is going to be important, because we're going to have a gap, but will we have a process that will move countries forward over time to take more aggressive action? Another important issue is transparency and accountability. The idea here is Dan Reif-Snyder, who's an important member of the U.S. delegation, describes this as a fishbowl effect, to have reporting rules that are very open, transparent, so everybody knows what everybody's doing and we understand what progress they've made or progress they haven't made, and that creates an atmosphere in which countries will be challenged to deliver on what they've committed to and also step up their action over time. So that's an important issue in these discussions. Another one is a phrase that you'll see all over the convention, common but differentiated responsibilities and respective capabilities. The basic idea here has been, up until recently, there's been a sharp divide of what countries are asked to do, the form of their commitments, where you've got a very different structure for developed countries versus developing countries. And these rules would apply purely based upon whether your country is classified as one or the other. They've moved in a direction now where they've softened that sum, and so these nationally determined contributions, now each country is in a sense defining for itself sort of what are they able to do, what's their capacity, what's their responsibility, and it's sort of self-determined what that's going to be. There's still a lot of push on that, where some countries are going to want to go back to that more categorical developed versus developing country approach, and so that'll be an interesting thing to watch. For the developing countries, a key aspect here is, will the things that they are saying they're willing to do, will they be linked formally in the agreement to how much finance assistance they get from the developed countries? Will it be linked to efforts on technology development and transfer to assist them, or building capacity in their countries? So that's one of the key issues for them, is linking what they will be doing to implement their contributions to what other wealthier countries are doing to provide some support. A big aspect of that is the Green Climate Fund, which nominally is supposed to be $100 billion by 2020, and there's a lot of discussion of as to how that fund is going to be, where the resources are going to come from, how that's going to operate. Another sort of set of issues for the developing world is how much emphasis will there be on issues of adaptation, loss and damage, sustainable development, poverty eradication. So they're pushing to have each of those issues get more prominent treatment. So what are we likely to get? What outcomes might actually emerge from Paris? I think, you know, it's very likely that there will be an agreement reached, and it will be an agreement that will include all countries. So you won't, you know, the U.S. will no longer be sitting on the sidelines like we did with the Kyoto Protocol. You'll see China, India, the major emerging economies will be included in substantive ways, as will many other countries. It's going to be based on this idea of the self-defined nationally determined contributions. It's a lot more than what maybe looked conceivable a few years ago, but nowhere near what's needed to get to a path that's consistent with limiting warming to 2 degrees or less by the end of the century. Is that going to be a disaster or not? There'll be differing views on that. For me, it depends very much on what happens in terms of this transparency and accountability issue of, do they really have reporting requirements that will allow everyone to understand who's doing what, how much are they doing, is it effective, and what more might need to be done. And then this process of periodic reviews and updating of commitments so that we move that needle on just how much countries say they're willing to do. In closing, the last thing I want to say is sort of, Paris is not the be-all and end-all. The action doesn't end with Paris. Whether it's a success or failure in Paris is not a function of what the words are in any agreement that comes out of that meeting. It really depends on what we do. It depends on actors in colleges and universities, in the business sector, in civil society, individuals acting as involved citizens, community activists, that an agreement doesn't cause emissions to reduce. Okay, we have to make sure that in all the spheres that we act and have some influence, that we start doing more to take action on climate change. And a big part of that, I think, is changing the political climate. That going forward, we need to think about how do we make it so that it is just politically untenable for somebody to deny that climate change exists or is caused by humans or is of significant such significance that we need to act on it. So we need to be thinking about how we change the political climate in our society. So that's it for my prepared comments, and happy to take any questions.
That's great. I'm going to exert my own privilege as a professor and ask the first question. And that really loops back to your initial comments on the multiple roles that observers can play, both at the meetings and afterwards. And I'm very interested in asking you, do observers, if you're talking about delegates from countries that don't have as much capacity or person power, for example, as the U.S., do observers make those kinds of connections with official delegates that you were talking about in terms of knowledge sharing or not just pressuring, but enabling or supporting those delegations? And second, when observers go home, do they have or have they played historically or can they play kind of a critical role in maintaining or expanding an interest at the domestic level? So if a country, we come away with some sort of agreement and it's very much premised on the idea that individual nations will live up to their pledges, and if we need to push them further to address the gap, can those kinds of networks mm-hmm. and connections that are created at the meetings, can they roll back at the domestic level or create transnational pressures? I'm just curious about that.
Yeah, those are excellent questions. So on the first one, there very definitely are observer organizations where a major focus for them is helping build the capacity and help support the delegations from particularly the least developed countries or sometimes the small island states in particular. There's a group in the UK called FIELD. Can't remember what the acronym stands for, but it's a legal group. And they've played substantial roles, substantive roles, in the national delegations for small island states and advising them on positions to take and how to be more effective in the negotiations. There are other groups that do provide training for national delegates from developing countries, so that happens a good deal. There's also, I know that, you know, some colleges and universities will get their students involved in ways to be supportive of some groups. Doreen Stabinski at College of the Atlantic often has her students linked with a national delegation to provide support for them. So that definitely does go on. On the role of observer organizations, you know, stateside, back home, when they go back to the countries in which they mainly operate. Varying degrees of what goes on there. Some are very engaged. There's the Climate Action Network, which tries to continue to maintain connections with several hundred environmental groups around the world to support each other. They play a role in, you know, they're hoping to organize a march on November 29th, so they're very active. We're seeing faith groups get more and more involved now. I think the papal encyclical will play some role there, and I think we're going to see faith groups playing more of a role. I think thus far, many of these groups have tried to you know, advocate and make things happen domestically, but certainly in the U.S. there's been limited success on that. But I think it's an area which is going to have to be a stronger focus going forward.
I'm going to turn the questions over to Colin Adkins. He's a graduate student here at the Center for Environmental Policy.
All right.
Hi, Dr. Leary. Thank you so much for joining us today. I have many questions, but I guess I'll just start with one that you touched on earlier about not current projections are kind of estimating that we're not going to get below that 2 degrees Celsius goal given the INDCs that are out there right now. So what do you see as sort of being the pieces of the agreement that we're going to need in order to give that agreement enough teeth and momentum to keep that 2 degrees Celsius goal alive?
Yeah, I think those are you know, the one of this idea of a periodic review and updating. And also the idea of having a very transparent and rigorous reporting system for accountability. So for this periodic review, I'm pretty sure that it's going to be in some form in the agreement that is reached in Paris. The question is how rigorous will it be? Will it be sort of, you know, countries are invited to periodically review and update, or will there actually be a requirement that on some schedule of every, you know, 5 years or whatever it might be that they're going to do this? So I think it'll be important to see the language, you know, being more, to the extent it can be prescriptive, doing so, of setting out a timeline for countries to do this. And related to that, coming into Paris, a term that I think it may have started with I think it was before Lima, maybe in Warsaw, but as countries were looking at these intended nationally determined contributions, that they not have what's been called backsliding. That means that when you step forward in Paris and say, this is what we're going to contribute to the global effort on climate change, it cannot be less than what you've already been doing or already committed to, that it has to be a step forward of more aggressive action. So in that periodic review, to the extent they can enforce it, of an understanding that, you know, every few years as you update your national plan, it should reflect more aggressive action going forward and should never be backsliding towards, you know, saying, oh, gee, we made an effort. It turned out to be more difficult than we thought. And so now we're going to weaken our commitments. So that will be an important aspect of it. And then the transparency and accountability part, which, you know, I think really can be a very effective thing. This is part of the role of observer organizations. If there are really clear rules, good ones, about what it is exactly that nations are supposed to report periodically about what are they doing, what impact is it having, clear measures of effectiveness, some criteria by which countries are saying these are the criteria by which we and you should hold us accountable for getting the job done. And, you know, civil society, the observer organizations, a big role for them is to really go and look at those reports and call nations out on, you know, this is deviating from what you said you were going to do, or maybe it's consistent, but the evidence shows that this wasn't enough, that you need to take further action. So I think that the reporting requirements, the transparency, accountability piece is an important tool.
Where are you going there? You need the credit card?
Thank you, Dr. Leary. I have just one other question, and then I'll turn it over to some others. So how will Paris end up being different from Copenhagen in handling the tensions between balancing emissions reductions and development in those developing countries?
Yeah, it's, you know, what happened in Copenhagen was one of the darker moments in the UNFCCC, where there were some who thought that as an institution, that it really was at the brink of just collapsing, because there was so much tension. Tension is probably too polite a word for it. There was a huge amount of frustration with the process and what went on there. Some of that was because I think there was, you know, expectations of what Copenhagen could deliver that was beyond what was really possible, and then also having a very what was viewed as a not transparent negotiating process. A lot of things happening behind closed doors, and the final agreement being knocked out by heads of state, including President Obama, without involving others. I think the UNFCCC learned many lessons from that, and have been trying to steer away from that kind of closed door approach, and are doing things more out in the open. So I think that will be helpful. I think going into this, you have, a really positive aspect of this is the bilateral agreement between the United States and China. And so that has been a contentious issue of what will China's role be in climate action. And so they've laid out what they're willing to do. You can quibble over whether it's enough or not, but this is just a fundamental major change in what China has been willing to commit to internationally. So that changes the dynamic of what's going on. And along with, you know, China taking that role and the U.S. Finally stepping up to do more than what we'd done a decade earlier, is creating an environment in which, you know, we're seeing India and Brazil and South Africa and Indonesia and a number of other developing countries really playing a more constructive role, at least so far it appears that way. Some of it, you know, there was the last meeting of the ad hoc working group on the Durban platform. I think it was the end of October that they met. There were some troubling signs there of a lot of dissension at that meeting, which may spill over into Paris and be a problem. But there's also on the positive side, there's a piece, I think it was written by Elliot Derringer at C2ES. Can't remember what that acronym stands for. They used to be the Pew Center on Climate. That organization has been party to a number of informal conversations that have been going on over this past year. And he wrote a piece that's online that basically says, you know, when you see what's been going on in those informal conversations, there's much more convergence on what should come out of Paris than what you're hearing in the official meetings that have happened as part of the ADP meetings that have gone on this year. So I'm, you know, trying to be hopeful about what goes on here. There's, I think, much better signs of a more productive meeting than what happened in Copenhagen. But there are still some fundamental differences which if they don't find creative ways to resolve them. You know, we could have an outcome similar to Copenhagen.
Great. We have a question from Dr. Gautam Sethi for you. He's an economist here at our program. And then I think after that, we'll open it up to some callers who are on the line.
All right.
Hi, Dr. Leary. I'm just curious to know a little bit more about sort of the commitments made by nation states and how soft or how sort of sincere they might be in terms of both their maybe their starting positions at these negotiations. Do they sort of come up with, do they softball the numbers, and do they then go up a little bit based on what others are proposing? Are those commitments sometimes contingent commitments or not? So China might say, I'll do this much. I'll do 20%. If India does 15%, but otherwise I'll do only 10.
Mm-hmm.
And to what extent, so it's sort of a, I'm trying to get a sense of that. And to what extent are observer groups able to influence those commitments? And finally, to what extent are those commitments prone to, say, a reversal by the legislatures of these countries? So the United States might agree to something, but the Senate refuses to pass it, and so it sort of gets rolled back domestically.
Yep. Yeah. Maybe I'll take that last one first. So, you know, a major issue for the U.S. is that an agreement in Paris that would require ratification by the U.S. Senate just would be dead. It's a non-starter. And so the strategy that the U.S. government has taken is the commitment they've put forward is entirely can be implemented through executive action. So it's based very much on the White House's estimates of what can be achieved through the Clean Power Plan, which is you know, in the process of being implemented, although it's going to be challenged in courts, and that could, if the court challenge succeeds, then we're in critical danger of not making our commitment. But there are other pieces as well there, which are all based on what the executive in the U.S. is capable of doing without legislation. Other countries have taken different approaches on that. You know, some of them are also sticking to stating contributions that they think are achievable only with existing legislation. Some, I think, the European Union, you know, their contribution is one that would require new legislation to happen, and so that's always sort of questionable as to will that legislation get passed? How will that happen? Some countries, as you suggested, have explicitly made their contributions contingent, that there are a few that have said, you know, we're willing to take the following actions and achieve the following results unconditionally, irregardless of what others will do, but we'll go a little farther and do more contingent upon how strong are the commitments, the actions of other countries. So that is a strategy that has been used by some. But it was one of the over this past year, in leading into this process of producing these INDCs, the intended nationally determined contributions, the sort of unspoken sort of culture of it is these should be a statement of the best you think you can do. You shouldn't be, you know, kind of holding your cards close to the vest and just promising something less than your best and then come forward in Paris with something more, because I wanted to have an opportunity for all the countries, you know, that have these contingent ideas to see what is it that other countries are planning to do so that they know before they get to Paris, they have a pretty good sense of what's on the table, what's feasible. And so the notion is that these 156 contributions that have been submitted to the UN, they are thought to be a statement of the best that can happen. In terms of what observers, what influence they can have, at this stage, I would suspect very little. The influence of observers is more at the stage of when proposals are being formed before they get submitted. One of the things that I've observed, and I've had this confirmed by talking to delegates, is there's very little margin for movement on substantive things at a conference. Because as you can imagine, you know, each of these delegations has formed a pretty strong idea of what is politically feasible back home, and have a fairly clearly defined sense of how far can they go and return back to their country and be confident that others will continue to support what was being done. International relations, international politics, one of the, you know, constant sort of issues in any field is, you know, that the sovereignty issue that you know, we have a 190 some sovereign nations which are only willing to secede limited amounts of sovereignty to an international agreement, and each of them retains the right through future political decisions, legislation, executive decisions to change things, agreements that they've entered into internationally. So whatever we agree in Paris is not necessarily set in stone for the years to come, that a country can always back out.
Great. I know we have other callers on the line, so if you would like to ask Dr. Leary a question, you can hit 5-star on your phone to join our conversation. In the meantime, I have a tag-on question to Gotham's, which is, you know, we've been reading a lot of literature and debates over this top-down versus bottom-up, and it sounds from your discussion and from some of the articles we've been reading in class that really the incentive or the carrot to get a shift from some of the problems at Copenhagen to the upcoming Paris is the fact that the bottom-up approach is the incentive in many ways for countries, that this is the sort of the most practical, strategic way of doing this. And I was just wondering about your views of this sort of tension between having a strong overarching agreement and the need for flexibility across countries.
Yeah, and that I think has been basically the, you know, probably a central issue. Even going back as far as Bali, but particularly coming out of Copenhagen, is this tension between a strong top-down agreement versus a bottom-up agreement. I imagine that some of the things that your students and you have been reading are probably some articles by Dan Bodansky, which if you haven't read those, you know, anything by Dan I think is, you know, really worth reading on these issues. And, you know, he sort of describes it, you know, he's got a lot of complex ideas on this, but one of the simple ones is just this idea of this trade-off between the more stringent you make the agreement in terms of the environmental outcome that you're looking for, of you really want to have, you know, aggressive reductions in emissions and you want to cap them at some low level that will get you to where you want to be, and you want them to be legally binding in some way. Those move in the direction of, you know, if you succeed, it will have, you know, a very positive environmental impact. But you may have relatively low participation, that you may have the United States bailing on the agreement or other key parties deciding that that's calling on them to do more than they're prepared to. In the other direction is this sort of bottom-up approach, which is primarily the approach that's being taken has moved in this direction of essentially the international agreement is made up of 190 some parties saying, this is what I am willing to do. The rest of you live with it. So the benefit there is you get much broader participation. You'll get closer to universal participation. But you'll also, the downside is, as the analysis of the contribution submitted before Paris has shown, is it doesn't add up to a whole lot. That what countries unilaterally are saying they're willing to do is not up to the task that we understand to be required. It's a difficult trade-off walking that line. And I hope that the route that they're going proves to be the right one of erring on the side of more flexibility, higher participation, with the hope that periodic reviews and other processes will address the weak environmental outcome in the future.
Jennifer Phillips. I'm one of the faculty here at the Center for Environmental Policy, and I have a question about these commitments. First of all, the 150 some odd that you say are being submitted, are all of those available for the public to look at mm-hmm. present?
Yeah, they're all available online. I think there are a variety of sources for them. The UNFCCC's website, you can access them on their website. And if you haven't, it's a little unwieldy to find everything that might be of use and value, but there's an enormous amount of information on the UNFCCC's website. It just takes some effort to figure out where to find the things that would be most valuable to you. But the INDCs are there. You can also find them a little bit more easily through the Climate Action Tracker group, and they provide a bit of analysis of the contributions as well. So you can find out what the contribution says, and you can also see the Climate Action Tracker's analysis of is it fair, is it equitable, is it sufficient relative to a standard that they've set of how they define those, you know, what's fair and what's sufficient.
So that's related to my main part of my question is the couple of examples that you gave of the commitment being put forth by the U.S. and by China and by India sound pretty, and Great Britain sound pretty substantial. And I'm wondering if the preliminary analysis that's been done by various groups out there, is there some elephant in the room that certain countries are totally not taking action on? I mean, the thing that comes to mind is deforestation in Brazil right now is evidently going back up through the roof after a lull earlier. But is there some obvious thing that's being missed that's heavily weighing toward this only 5% reduction that the sum of the parts is creating, or is it that overall, no one is really stepping up to the degree that we expect everyone is going to need to? Do you know if anyone has sort of done that analysis yet?
The Carbon Action Tracker is trying to do that. I'm trying to think what other groups. There's a group in India that I'm not sure how many of these contributions they've looked at, but they did a scathing critique of the U.S., INDC. I would, you know, my general sense, and I've not looked deeply into this at this point, but my general sense is that it's sort of a shared insufficiency that, you know, while what's being proposed by most developed countries is pretty aggressive compared to what we've done, you know, historically. But is not really up to the task of getting us to, you know, real deep reductions in carbon. Some of them, like, so the U.S., I don't think it's in our official contribution, but our stated policy is great for when you get way out into the distant future. I think for 2050, Obama has said our target is to have an 80% reduction in our emissions relative to 2005. It's an easier commitment to make because he's long gone before we you know, have to get there or know if we're going to get there. But so developed countries have stepped up. They're offering to do more than they've done before, but it is insufficient. And then the other part of the elephant is the developing countries where you know, as admirable as it is that the emerging economies are finally saying, yes, we're going to in an international document say, here's what we're going to do on this issue, and they're proposing some substantial things. You know, you're still, these analyses that are being done show carbon emissions still rising over time. Because a form of the commitment, say, from India, is that they are committing to reducing the carbon intensity of their economy. So what their commitment takes a form of a change, a reduction in the amount of carbon per dollar GDP. So it's basically moving them off a trajectory of substantially growing emissions over time to somewhat less substantially growing emissions over time. So that's an issue there. On the developing country side, though, they'll say that, you know, that is a fundamental issue that only gets resolved when Europe and the U.S. Really step up on finance, technology transfer, capacity building, that further action from the developing world is contingent upon those who some would say are responsible, historically responsible, for more than half of the emissions that are in the atmosphere, offer the level of support needed by the less well-off countries.
My name is Lucy. I'm a student here at CEP. I have a question regarding top-down versus bottom-up. Top-down approach is pretty much essentially driven by science, and the bottom-up is kind of politically based. And in looking at the kind of featured event speakers on the website, it looks like most of the people are that are featured are in government or like entrepreneurial side of things versus research-based. So I guess I have two kind of related questions. One, do you think that's like a that's just a tactic that we're looking at now in terms of looking at it from a bottom up, from that political side of things? And do you think that it'll be more successful given that policy decisions to mitigate climate change is inherently a political decision and not a scientific one?
Yeah, you know, I think that the shift to a more bottom-up approach is a pragmatic one of looking at, you know, 20 years of effort on international collaboration on climate change and recognizing that we really have, you know, the idea that we could do the equivalent of the Montreal Protocol in climate, we've demonstrated that just isn't happening. And what the reaction to that was, you know, say particularly after Copenhagen, you started to see cities taking positions of becoming carbon neutral. You have the state of California in the U.S. Taking substantial action. You see some of the private sector taking some important steps. So the reality is, over the last 10 years, most of the action on climate change has been bottom up. And so now the international regime is trying to figure out how to embrace that and make that work for them to move things forward. I'd like to just, you know, counter the notion that the top-down approach is science-based and not political. You know, my view is, and some will think this is sort of a heretical thing to say, you know, there is no threshold at which we know what is dangerous and what is not dangerous for climate change. There is nothing specific about 2 degrees centigrade that says warming up to that point, we're all fine, safe, and good, and even, you know, a tenth of a degree beyond that, all hell breaks loose and disaster befalls us. The reality is we're in a situation now that already has danger. And the more gases we put in the atmosphere, the greater that danger becomes. The scientific evidence seems to suggest, but this is, you know, it's not a really robust literature, but we know very robustly that the more greenhouse gases we put in the atmosphere, the greater the danger becomes, the greater the warming will be. But we don't have a real good sense of, like, well, you know, what really happens in between 2 and 3 degrees? Yeah, more bad stuff happens than between 1.5 and 2 degrees, but we're not sure how much more. There are some catastrophic things that those science suggests could happen. You know, certainly as you go, you know, beyond 3, that things look even more worrying. You know, so that 2-degree threshold, that's politically determined. That was arrived at in Copenhagen through a political process, drawing on the science very definitely. But, you know, there is no scientific basis for saying that you know, 2 degrees is okay and 2.1 is not, or that 2 degrees is okay, or 1.5 degrees is okay and 2 is not. You can draw on scientific evidence to help make your argument, but it's not definitive. You know, this is something where, you know, the fact is there's danger changing the climate at all, and it's a political normative decision as to how much is too much. My own sense is 2 degrees is, you know, probably not a bad choice politically of where to aim for. The one exception on the science, I would say, is when you look at the work of the paleoclimate scientists who try to understand how climate has changed over thousands to millions of years, and Jim Hansen and others looking at, you know, what sort of a world had ice on, you know, on the ice sheets of Antarctica and Greenland, and what sort of a world did not. And that threshold seems to be somewhere below 2 degrees. So that's one case where there does seem to be a scientifically based threshold to say, you know, that, you know, going above 2 degrees means a world without ice, and that means a world with much higher sea levels. Now, there's a lot of uncertainty, though, about is that within a couple of centuries? Is that within a couple of millennia? It's not so, the separation between science and politics is not so sharp.
Right. We have a couple of minutes left, and I wanted to ask you perhaps a final question, which is, you know, you mentioned the Montreal Protocol, and I'm thinking that, you know, one of the critical tools there to incorporate countries in the Global South was the multilateral fund. And perhaps you could talk to us just a little bit about the Green Climate Fund and its ability to organize both resources but also technology transfers, the kind of assistance that countries will need in the future, but many countries need now because of adaptation issues and challenges that they're facing currently.
Yeah, so that's been a really important area, and I think that is part of why we've seen a change in the tenor of the negotiations, is that there has been, not a great amount, but there has been some improvement in resources being provided to support developing countries on adaptation issues, on resilience building, on connecting climate action to sustainable development measures. And you know, those are the things that will create some commonality with particularly the least developed countries, where, you know, they very strongly and I think rightly see it as, you know, mitigation of climate change is not their job. And so involving them in these other aspects that strike more directly at what are their risks, what are their vulnerabilities, how are those addressed, and as the international community addresses those directly, will create, I think, a much more positive climate for action internationally and through bilaterals as well. The Green Climate Fund, there's a lot of disagreement about how that's going to come forward, whether it's going to be public money, private money, will it be grants, will it be loans. Those are difficult conversations where there are very different expectations in the developing world versus the developed as to how that's going to work. I've heard people describe the $100 billion per year goal for 2020 as being, you know, it's a small amount of money. It's surprising how much heat is generated over arguing about it. But when you put that in context of, the annual official international aid that goes from country to country is in the order of like $135 billion a year. So an additional $100 billion is not insubstantial. And so I think, you know, that it is a lot of resources that's being talked about. Whether it's going to truly be additional is going to be a big issue. I don't know. I've kind of talked around your question, but
I think that that's a good answer. It's a tough question. So I just, it's been a super interesting conversation, and we're really lucky to have had your input about the upcoming negotiations and how you've linked it very well and helped us think about its connections to past negotiations. We're drawing to a close, and I just need to remind the audience that in 2 weeks we'll have our own director, Eben Goodstein, who will be reporting directly from Paris and giving us an update. And again, it's a shocking set of circumstances surrounding Paris, and I'm saddened by that. We can't end the hour without mentioning that again. And thank you for your supportive words at the beginning as you introduced your own talk. I do want to ask you, a minute to wrap up, sort of what are your final thoughts or perhaps your own personal expectations about the experience that you're going to have as an observer in the Paris negotiations?
It's always very mixed, going to these conferences. They can be very frustrating, but it's also, I try to take a very positive view of what's going on. The fact that we have, you know, representatives of basically every member of the United Nations coming together each year to talk about climate change. I try to take a good deal of you know, from that as like this is an extraordinarily positive thing, while trying to overlook what I heard the representative from Saudi Arabia say that morning that was just dumbfoundingly just frustrating. So it is an emotional roller coaster going to these meetings. But I think, you know, this is I think the expectations are both sufficiently ambitious yet reserved that I think we're going to have good outcomes from this meeting. And so I'm looking forward to that. I think the real struggle for the United States is, you know, what comes after an Obama presidency, and will political changes here reverse the positive direction that we're moving in on climate in this country? And again, that, you know, the comment I made earlier about, you know, we need to like make this issue something that is not bipartisan, that it really should be politically untenable for somebody from any political party to say climate change is not happening, it's not caused by humans, it's unimportant, we don't need to take action on it. You know, we need to just make that politically untenable so people who say that it's more widely understood that's a very self-serving position to take that just has no basis in the world we live in.
No, we completely agree with you, and thank you for those final words, and look forward to hearing from you in the future. Thanks a lot, Arun.
All right.
And okay, we'll be back in 2 weeks with Eben Goodstein from Paris.
Thank you for the opportunity.
No, I think he just means.